The Bulls are battling the reigning NBA champion Milwaukee Bucks in round one of the NBA playoffs. Keep it on the score as we continue our coverage of this huge series for the Bulls. We are Sports Radio 670 The Score, official radio home of the Chicago Bulls. Live from the Hyundai Studios, presented to you by your local Hyundai dealers. We are WSCR and HD Chicago, WBMX HD2 Chicago, and Odyssey Station. The Score!
Top of the hour is being brought to you by DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. And this hour is being brought to you by Team Hochberg. Visit their website, 56David.com. That's 56David.com. Ray, let's go.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score in Odyssey Station. James Fegan, White Sox reporter for The Athletic.
Yes, James.
On Twitter at JR Fegan.
I can anticipate this question. It's probably way too early, but...
Excellent. Too soon. Too soon.
Asking the questions to get the answers you need.
If you knew that Abreu was available to be the runner there, would you have gone to him instead of Hendricks?
Yeah, if I'd known that, I'd know that. I'd check the rule. I'm guessing you know the rules better. Now I know.
James Fegan with Lawrence Holmes on 670 The Score.
The White Sox are snowed out in Cleveland, but there is still a lot of stuff to talk about when it comes to said White Sox. James Fegan joins me on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Mr. Fegan, how are you today?
I'm not sitting in the snow or playing in 38-degree weather like yesterday, so the weekend has been relaxing to me comparatively to other people in the White Sox universe.
Okay, that's cool. But before we talk about the White Sox, this is just kind of a fishing expedition by me. You're a region guy, right? You grew up in the region, or did you just live in the region?
I grew up in Hyde Park, Kenwood. Technically Kenwood, but you know how you know how Kenwood kind of gets lumped in.
It is become like a thing, and people don't know where it's like almost like an annex, and Woodlawn is kind of getting annexed into it too. Now, which is really, really strange. So, Bulls fan?
Yeah. I mean, Michael Jordan, my uncle grabbed season tickets, like, the night he was drafted, which was, like, definitely, without a doubt, like, the most smart purchase my uncle has ever made his entire lifetime. So, I saw a lot of, like, Jordan and Pippen, like, in person as, like, a six-year-old, and if you don't become a Jordan fan watching him as, like, a little kid, I think you're on the path to sociopathy, which... somehow I avoided.
So now are you into what's happening with the Bulls at all, or has baseball got you too busy?
I think like the two like main pure sources of fanhood left in my life are Bulls basketball and Notre Dame basketball, because that's where I went to school. But obviously if you follow the football program, especially if you have to cover them, it kind of feels a little bit more like a very operator type program, and it doesn't feel as innocent and pure as maybe watching Mike Bray try to make it to the Sweet 16 with a bunch of grad transfers.
Okay, that's fair. So what have you thought about the Bulls so far this season?
for a very large stretch of time, it was like the source of like brightness in my life during the middle of the lockout and everything being shut down. And like I tweeted it yesterday, but like, you know, the meme of Stringer Bell saying we back up with the Bulls hat on, like that's how we felt in November and December. And now I'm just like, all right, here it comes. Just get it over with. We're about to be put out of our misery, and I hope it's quick and gentle.
It's so weird. Like my experience was similar. Like my uncle had tickets, and we used to go to games when I was a kid. Like that's something like some of my best memories as a child was he would always take me and my brother. We would always get the Christmas game. Like it'd be Christmas game versus the Knicks. It's like, we going to the game today. We going to go to downtown. Like it was always exciting, man. It's hard to put into words what those games and that feeling of being around the Jordan Bulls was like.
It was very much, that and growing up watching Frank Thomas, it was, you watch someone and you kind of assume something went wrong when he didn't get on base. You kind of assume like something went wrong, or like there's a glitch in the game, or you need to like smack your television when the Bulls didn't win. It was a very weird way to come up as a fan that thankfully like Bears season would roll around and then you're like, oh, this is how things are normally supposed to feel. Like it's extremely difficult to win all the time. But that kind of set a weird expectation level, which translates now to where you know, by a reasonable standard, the White Sox are very successful and good team these last couple of years, but they want to win a World Series. So you're holding them to this higher standard of, you know, being better than everyone, not just reasonably good.
I'm looking forward to your hits in September when I can also ask you about the Bears, because I think that would be kind of interesting. Now, Ray, put it on the list of things that we're going to ask Fegan in September. We're going to ask him about the Bears, and then he's going to get angry about the Bears, which is good. White Sox, you keep. I always say, man, you can't go broke taking a profit. They're winning series. They won the series against the Rays. They now have this first game snowed out in Cleveland. What were some of the best things that happened for the White Sox this weekend?
I would say the best, this is random and very insidery, but like the best thing was they had a one-run lead against a good team on Friday night. So what did they do? They went to the recipe. They went to Aaron Bummer, they went to Kendall Graveman, they went to Liam Hendricks. Those are the guys you're supposed to bring in to lock up a one-run game. Bummer's a little shaky, but he got through it. He's having a weird thing with his sinker command right now, which is makes it really convenient that he's developed this plus slider out of nowhere in the last few years to kind of bail him out. But, you know, all that aside, the next game you have the very same thing. You just used all these guys. You've been using them heavily all year because your starters aren't going very long. That they are able to go and win another one-run game by using Bennett Souza and Jose Ruiz to get the bridge to Hendricks, who then wound up being the most dramatic inning. But you talked plenty about how Jose Ruiz was not a guy you trusted to go out of low leverage last season. And Bennett Souza was literally not on the team last year. He was probably in double A this time, that you're able to kind of turn to those guys and use them as high leverage, or basically be able to go through two straight games of using guys to protect the one-run lead, and you can trust all of them to some degree. Obviously just one outing, but, you know, Ruiz has looked pretty good so far this year. That's big, and that's part of the reason why this team is 6-3 in a stretch where, if you look at all the injuries they lost, and you look at the fact that they're playing, you know, all three teams. You can have your questions about Detroit, and I certainly do. All teams that hope to make the playoffs this year and extend the playoffs and come out as well as they have, you have to win, even if you can look at the offense not producing as much as you want and all of these things that might be red flags when you're talking about, is this the best team in all of baseball? But they've gotten to the stretch where you could really think, like, hey, if they just kind of stay 500 with all the things they're dealing with, that'd be fine, better than they would because some of these guys have stepped up.
How did the White Sox feel about how Dallas Keuchel pitched?
I think they have to be fine with it. One, he was pitching in a monsoon a little bit. That seemed to throw off Robbie Ray, of all people, as much as it did him. And I would say there's kind of a weirdness of the fifth inning with a couple of plays that could have been made, a couple of dribblers they got out of it. It wasn't 2020, where he basically carried that team to the playoffs to a big degree that I think shouldn't get overlooked too much when you're evaluating his White Sox tenure when it's all said and done. But it was a lot more what you're hoping for the third year of Dallas Keuchel look. When he got signed, Rick Hahn was not, you know, touting, you know, we got the 2015, 2016 Cy Young and he's back, baby. He's saying, if this guy eats innings, if this guy has an ERA in the fours and he's like the good leader in the clubhouse, like that's what we want. We want stability, given that we can't necessarily say that we have another, you know, rotation eligible starter who's going to come up in the next couple of years and he's going to fill that role for us. If that's the Dallas Keuchel you get all year long, yeah, it didn't look like the 2020 guy, like dominant or anything like that, but it definitely looked like somebody who wasn't putting himself behind in counts repeatedly the way he did last year, and it wasn't somebody who was, you know, putting runners on and making the damage worse. Dallas Keuchel, you know, when he was in his prime, was not a guy who could have this stuff just blow away everybody if he's falling behind 2-0, or he can get a bunch of strikeouts if he's walking the bases and putting 2-3 runners on every inning. If he's getting hit, that's one thing, that'll happen, but if he's not making his own trouble the way he was in the second half of last season, that's going to be a usable starter more often than not.
James Fegan covers the White Sox for The Athletic. You should get a subscription. You should be able to read the work that he does when he does White Sox coverage, and he's nice enough to join us on Mondays here on The Score throughout the season. Dylan Cease with another solid performance. We talked about it a little bit last week. He seems more comfortable with who he is as a pitcher. How did that happen?
I mean, he's had these four pitches for a while now. I think the ability to kind of have more of a general idea of where he's throwing them, have a kind of consistency of how that changeup is coming off his hand, or the fact that he has this ability to land the slider to such a degree that he can turn to it half the time, really put, like, if you look at break him down on how he got hit last year, it was really just a lot of you know, turning the fastball and fastball counts, and as tempting as it is to kind of just try to ride 98 at the letters because you can, and because it should be an effective pitch, he made himself a little bit predictable in that respect last year. And I think I remember watching him in spring training in 2018, and he was blowing away these major league hitters, but he was blowing them away by falling behind and then just, you know, throwing a bunch down the pipe and doing here, hit it. Over the course of a 162-game season, that has kind of diminishing returns. So the fact that he's able to kind of turn that slider in basically every count and trust it to the degree that he has, I think is what has made him take the leap. As much as the first couple of years of his struggles were about not being able to command that fastball at all and you know, consistently putting himself behind in the count, the fact that even when he does that now, he thinks he can land that slider, it's got such a high spin. I think it's averaging 2,900 his last time out, that he can kind of even throw it high in the zone, even if it's not intentionally, but if he doesn't have to command it pinpoint is what I mean, and get strikes, that can kind of get him out of those situations a lot more than just riding 97, 98 down the pipe and saying, here, hit it all the time.
There's a portion of the Vincent Velasquez start that was a disaster, like his fielding in the first inning of that. And then there's a portion where if I squint and I turn my head sideways, I go, oh, there's some positivity that can be taken from him reacting the way that he did, settling down and looking like he feels healthy. What did he take away from yesterday's start?
Mostly frustration that, yeah, he had good stuff yesterday. He showed the ability to kind of execute consistently for prolonged stretches. He was pretty stretched out. He probably could have gone six if he had not blown up the first inning. But those kind of little pockets, those kind of little stretches amid long displays of how talented he is, yeah, that kind of speaks to why the White Sox are interested in him, why they have confidence in him. But I think you could talk to anybody who watched the Philadelphia Phillies for 5 years and saw, like, yeah, we know Vince Velasquez is very talented, but these little stretches come up where he gets hit harder than he should or he loses the feel for the zone a little bit. And ironing those out is kind of the whole story. So, yeah, I get why he's a good option for them to fill in starts right now. I see why definitely you think if you can kind of iron out those stretches and bring more consistency, he should be someone who is a viable starter in the major leagues. But this is kind of the battle he's been fighting for a few years now. And the White Sox kind of, it behooves them to kind of demonstrate, you know, what their plan is or how they're able to iron it out. Now, maybe the long term down the road, you have Giolito and Lance Lynn is back. Maybe, you know, a month from now, we're all, you know, patting ourselves, trying not to faint by how in love we are with Johnny Cueto and the shimmy and whatnot. And maybe Vince Velasquez is not a necessary, like, part of the picture. And he's more of a guy who can come in what Ronald Lopez is doing right now and, you know, look kind of great for an inning or two. And you don't really need to stretch him beyond that or make sure it's more consistent. But right now, I think, yeah, it was very intriguing. I wouldn't be surprised if he's able to harness that next time, start out and have good. But these are the little things that have popped over the course of his career that has made his record not look as good as maybe it should based on talent. So the White Sox haven't got maybe as long to operate with them in spring or off season the way they would. You know, the famous story with Ethan Katz and Carlos Rodon is that he was ironing out his delivery so soon after the season ended that they had to stop when Rodon had non-tendered and then re-signed him. So they weren't able to do that during the lockout since they just signed him during spring training. But this is kind of the battle since Velasquez. So, yeah, it looks a little bit encouraging amid the struggles, but, you know, how are you going to eliminate those struggles? Because that's been the story for a bit.
Okay, James, I'm giving you over-under here. The number is 40.1%. Are you going to go over or under the amount of games caught by Reese McGuire?
I would have definitely said under when he got signed or when he got traded for first week. But he's been running 50% for a while now. And, you know, it's funny. When I asked Yasmani, like, after he hit that home run in Detroit, because we had talked in the offseason, he said, like, I'm just excited to go into spring training healthy, not have any issues. Because if I have, when I have a normal spring training, I have a big year. And so I said, you know, you look good at the plate today. Do you feel like you got to have the spring training that you're set up for normally? He's like, yeah, honestly, no. I feel like we're still kind of, you know, not going to be at bats that I wanted because I was kind of making sure, talking to trainers, making sure my knees were in a good place to manage my workload in spring. And sure enough, you know, now he's gone through a little bit of inconsistency of the plate. He's still kind of finding his rhythm because he didn't get those at bats in spring that he wanted. And alongside of that, we're seeing a lot more days off. He's working around 50-50 with the plate. obviously they feel comfortable with Reese McGuire's defense to a degree. That's part of it, that they feel like they're not going to kind of lose it much defensively if they do go with them back there, even if they're not going to get offense. I still think that over the second half, if Yasmani's feeling good, and certainly if he's hitting as well as he always has, that you know, play distribution should shift a little bit. But it seems like this could be something that they do for a little bit of really, you know, kind of work borderline 50-50, especially given how many day games they have in the first half of the season when it's cold weather and they don't play a lot of weekend night games, that this could be something they ride for a while. I still want to say under, but I if you set it at 35%, I think I'd have to go over.
Okay. Well, all right. It's something that we'll keep an eye on throughout the rest of the season. Sample size at this point of the season is ridiculously small. It's hard for us to make any sort of determination on what's going on with a player. But over the last four games, I got to tell you, watching Luis Robert at bats, it's looked like late 2020 Luis Robert at bats. And I wasn't expecting him to have four games where he goes hitless. What are pitchers doing to him?
I feel like they're just kind of, I haven't broken it down a ton, but they're getting him the ground out more than anything. He's not striking out. He's not chasing out of the zone, but he is kind of rolling over stuff outer half or getting jammed to some degree. I think he's generally got a little bit in love with how much you can drive the ball the other way. And so the natural thing when somebody's punishing you that is see if you can stretch them out a little bit more off the edge of the plate or really on the edges and see if they'll continue to go after it because they've had success. So I feel like he's in a little bit of rut with that and rolling over a lot of balls, but he's in general still kind of going along with the team-wide trend of not striking out, not doing kind of ridiculous chasing, and not doing a ton of swing and miss. But I think he just had a really good stretch of going the other way and really driving ball for power that, you know, they're able to kind of take him out of the zone a little bit more in that direction. Now, four games of him doing that, disappointing, but I, when you bring up last year, 2020, that was a month of doing that. So I think the really big stretch, or the especially now with the kind of an off day thrown in for Luis Robert to prove that he's taking another level, is making that more of a one series or 1 week thing and not something that kind of takes him out of commission for a month. That's really going to be the difference maker. 0-16 stretch, certainly ugly for him. Certainly not something that's befitting of maybe the MVP talk that a certain writer might have pumped up at the beginning of the season. But I think if he shows that he can correct it on a game-to-game, week-to-week basis, you're still looking at a guy who is, you know, one of the best, you know, two hitters in the league and not someone who is learning how to hit major league pitching the way he was at the end of 2020.
James, what did TA and TLR say about TA's decision to come home with the tying run on second base and then being thrown out at the plate?
I think, you know, he didn't address it specifically, but for me, it kind of spoke to where the offense was. You know, we talked to Tim Anderson at the beginning of the season about, you know, stealing, and he said, like, that's not really the plan. This, you know, when he was stealing a bunch of bases, I think, what was it, 2018, 2019, where he stole, like, over 20, that was an offense that kind of was hoping, like, well, hopefully TA will make something happen and we'll score some runs. And this is an offense that's a lot more like Tim Anderson's supposed to hit 300 and we're supposed to drive him in, and he's not supposed to be burning out his legs doing superhuman efforts the way he has to in the past. So the fact that he was doing that, I thought it spoke to, like, yes, it was a, you know, technically a mistake. To me, watching that game, it very much seemed like they're not scoring unless he's making something happen. But this is a statement on where the offense is, that they're trying to manufacture right now, that they stole three bases in an inning, that, you know, they won their last game by Luis Robert running around and manufacturing runs. This is just showing that they're not hitting right now, that he feels like this is the way to do. Because normally he is a very, you know, he was someone who stole a very high percentage at the start of his career very successfully. He's always been very choosy. So for him to do something over aggressive like that kind of speaks to just the bats being cold right now and feeling like he needs to make something happen.
James, enjoy a night in Cleveland with no baseball. So what do you do? Are you going to go out and, like, find a good place to eat? Like, what's the move?
So I have to confess, I was skipping the Cleveland trip and I was going to Minnesota. So I am probably going to Armoire shopping as a result of this.
All right. I think that's a really good idea. Have fun, and I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
That's James Feagan. Dang, I caught him off. That's on me, Ray. So let you control that. You can get a subscription to The Athletic by going to The Athletic. I have one. It's like $7 a month. It's great. And then I get access to him and Darnell. Like, I'm covered. Johns, all of The Athletic people. Ken Rosenthal's. Yeah, I'll put an S on his name. All that over at The Athletic. And I didn't know that James was that big of a Bulls fan. That's good to know. I wonder if he thinks that they're going to get blown out in game two. Because I do. I really do. I think they're going to get blown out in game two. And my definition of blown out is the spread plus one. If you get beat by more than the spread, you got blown out. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to take some more of your phone calls about the Bulls. If you want to talk about game one, you're like, we have to get through baseball talk of a first place team. Dang it. Well, now's your opportunity. 312-644-6767. And when we return, I asked an expert about deferring offense, like watching Patrick Williams specifically in deferring offense. You'll hear what that expert says next here on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com in Odyssey Station.
We know we're a good team. We just have to do the right things over and over again and stay with it. And I thought tonight was a good response compared to what happened to finish the regular season of when we get down, that we responded and we stuck with it. And it wasn't a pretty game. You know, a lot of guys missed, you know, a lot of shots, but we just stuck with it. We just kept fighting. We did all the little things. And, I mean, down the stretch, you know, a couple shots going in, we know we have maybe a chance to win the game. So it's just how it is. You have to put whatever happened behind you and move on and just, you know, move on to the next play, next game. So tonight, obviously, was a close one. We had a chance. We didn't. We came up short. No, now we got to focus on game two.
That is Vooch talking about what happened in the Bulls game one loss to the Bucks, 93-86. He finished the game with 24 points, 17 rebounds on 9 of 27 shooting. Zach, DeMar, and Vooch combined for 21 of 71. That's probably not a good thing for your team to win games. I'm stuck in this space in talking about the Bulls game yesterday of wanting to shine a light on their level of effort and compete, as the people in football compete, their competitiveness. I was impressed by them taking that punch from the Bucks early on in the game when it looked like that was going to be a runaway. It looked like in the first 5 minutes of that game that the Bucks were going to blow the Bulls out and the route was on and the sweep was on and everything else. So there's a part of me that goes, man, y'all were right there. And you did the city proud by not rolling over and dying in that first five-minute chunk. You did the city proud by taking a five-point lead late in the game. You did the city proud by sticking with the best player on the championship team for 47 minutes and 40 seconds. You were right there. And then I found myself being angry about all of the things that went into that game not being won. I'm not usually like this. I like usually it's like you lost the game, you lost the game. And maybe people who are arguing this are right, that we are giving the Bulls too much credit for almost winning. Someone texted earlier, and I think it's a good point. Anthony Edwards is 20 years old, too. And Anthony Edwards is out here dunking on people. Now, I get that he's a different type of dude, but that's a guy that was playing in his first playoff game. And look at what he did. There's a lot of guys that have been inexperienced in playoff situations. And I know that the play-in games don't technically count. It was described as statistically, the statistics from it vanish, because they don't count for the regular season and they don't count for the playoffs. But even seeing a player like Darius Garland, for example, do work in those games is fun. I'm not sure what to do with my feelings other than to try and be well-rounded on this. To tell you that, yeah, I saw it. I saw them be competitive. I saw them compete. I saw them not back away from the challenge of Giannis Antetokounmpo. But I also saw them do stuff that drove me crazy.
They try.
That Zach 30-footer will stay in my mind. It's such a terrible shot. And the thing is that while it's a shot that Zach has hit before, it's a terrible shot for the situation. It's a terrible shot because it's a 30-footer. And I'm going, what are you doing? You were down 3. You weren't down 5. If you were down 5, I would understand. We got to get this bucket quick. And if I shoot this quick enough, then we'll have an opportunity if we just get a defensive stop on the other end. No, you just came out just like, screw it. I'm going to shoot. Shoot a shot. And it was a terrible idea. DeMar out here getting triple team is still like, nope, I'm going to shoot it. No, man, it's some of those situations you got to pass. Vooch taking threes, he know damn well he shouldn't be taking. It's like, I shouldn't be mad at Vooch because what the Bulls asked Vooch to do yesterday was incredible. And I thought that he was up for the challenge, but stop taking three-pointers. Get your big ass down in the post. So I'm stuck, y'all. Like, for example, had the Bulls won, we would have spent 20 minutes talking about Alex Caruso's defense yesterday. He played great defense on the perimeter. Part of the reason that Jrue Holiday and Chris Middleton didn't shoot well is because Alex Caruso. Oh, one more thing about DeMar. I brought it up on Twitter last night, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the Bucks do with this in game 2. You know how DeMar has got the great shot fake? Like, his shot fake gets people up in the air. He ends up getting fouled, like all sorts of stuff. Giannis cracks me up because Giannis is long enough to defend the shot effectively without jumping. And there were 2 moments in yesterday's game where DeMar is being guarded by Giannis. And he gave him the pump fake. And you could just kind of see Giannis being like, I'm not falling for the banana in the tailpipe. Now enjoy this 7'6 wingspan. I don't have to jump, bro. I can contest your shot from here. I wonder if they'll use him on him a little bit more. He is a freak, man. Seeing the stuff that he can do is pretty incredible. On Friday's show, I was talking with Stephen Bardo, who's great because he did color for the Bucks this year and he did color for the Bulls this year and did a tremendous job wherever he was. I asked him about Patrick Williams because in Stephen's college career, he was on a team full of really good scorers. Now, he was the point guard, so it makes things a little bit easier. But I was asking him about deferring your offense to the betterment of your teammates. Here's what he told me.
This is going to sound weird, Lawrence, but I think Patrick Williams should really look at Ayo Dosunmu. Ayo has really figured out where he can be a double-digit scorer for the Bulls and not take anything away from Zach or DeMar. So what Ayo does, he sets up weak side, and he's ready. He's in anticipation mode, even when he's on the weak side. Sometimes I think Patrick is not ready in that scenario. Ayo will run the floor. He'll get a kick out for an outlet pass, and he'll try to beat defenders with his speed. What does Patrick Williams have that other guys don't have? Well, he's got great body balance. I think he's a lot stronger than even Patrick understands. And so there are nuances in the game on the offensive glass, being on the weak side, getting deflections defensively, getting steals and runouts, just making yourself almost like a safety blanket. Here's an example. Watch Pat Connaughton when he's on the floor with Giannis Antetokounmpo. Pat Connaughton is a security blanket for Giannis. Wherever Giannis moves, Pat Connaughton kind of moves just opposite to stay in the vision of Giannis. If Patrick Williams can figure out a way to be a security blanket like Ayo Dosunmu has, if he can be a security blanket for DeMar and Zach and them get more confidence in him, giving up some of their opportunities to get Patrick going, I think that he can find a lot of success and he can be a double-digit scorer even with all these other options on the floor.
Great stuff from Stephen Bartle as per usual. And you're right, like seeing a player stay tethered to the guy that's going to get double and being ready like that. There's a lot of stuff in there. When Stephen said he's got to be ready for that ball to come out. And what happened in last night's game? There was an opportunity for Patrick Williams to shoot an open three. He wasn't ready. And then he ends up passing the ball to DeMar, and it's like, okay, now the offense has to start all over again. Take that shot, young man. The other part in there that Steven says that it's a delicate thing. As someone who hosts a talk show, I feel it necessary to point this stuff out. I also understand that by pointing it out, I am helping to create a narrative that is then going to be used to defame Patrick Williams. So as I say that, I want to be fair to him, but I also have to be fair to what my eyes see. And what Steven said there is Patrick Williams is strong enough, so strong that even Patrick doesn't understand. That's what I'm trying to get to. I need to get to why doesn't he get that he also is a freak? Go play like one. And it might be demeanor. Some guys are built one way. Some guys are built the other way. That he might be on a team full of guys that need their shots, and he recognizes that. And he's okay, like, waiting his turn, like, quote unquote. We might just be looking at a player that's extremely selfless and is trying to find his way. But when you look at him and you go, man, all of the stuff is there. All of the stuff. You got all the things. I got into a text discussion. So I have a text thread with Herbie and Campy and Tony Gill. And so we were talking about it, and I won't tell you everything I said in the text, because some of the stuff that I say in text, I wouldn't say on the air because I would get thrown off the air. But we ended up in a conversation. Tony and I were kind of going back and forth about Lauri Markkanen. And to me, Markkanen and P. Will are similar, where you go, hey, man, you've got all the things. Why aren't you better? Because I can see all of the stuff. And so, you know, I feel like Tony was doing a little revisionist history with Lauri Markkanen. Markkanen was one of those dudes, you're like, hey, you're 7 feet and you're athletic. Get your ass to the post. I want to see the best version of Patrick Williams. And I'm hopeful that it really is in there, that guy that we think is in there is actually in there. But he has to come to grips with, it's okay for you to be a bully. I don't mean in your regular life. Like, Patrick Williams doesn't seem like the type of person that would be a bully in regular life. On the floor, though, he can be a bully. He can do some of the way that, not the playing the same, but the way that Giannis carries himself on the floor, the way that you don't want to get in his way on a fast break, the way that you don't want to necessarily body up against him to get rebounds. And P. Will did that last night. I'll give him credit for that. the way that he runs the floor. He runs the floor with purpose and anger and fury. That's what I want to see Patrick Williams do. Make them get out of your way, man. Like, that, these dudes in a league full of physical freaks, you're one of the guys that matches up against a lot of them. These guys should be, they should be running for cover in transition when Patrick Williams is coming down the floor. And there's been too many moments when I watch him in transition where I am seeing a guy with his hands up because he doesn't want to hit anyone. And I know this isn't football, but nah, fam, you need to start going downhill at these dudes and let them know what it is. Let them know that if you stand it on the tracks, your ass is going to get run over. That's all I want to see. So I was joking with Dan today. There's a part of me that wants Billy Donovan to go, Patrick, I'm going to play you for 15 minutes, and that's it. Leave no stone unturned. In the 15 minutes that you're out there, cause a ruckus. And maybe they've tried that, and maybe that's not the way to get through to them. Not everyone can be coached that way, and that's part of the job of teaching or coaching, is figuring out what button to push to try and get a player to maximize their potential. But I swear, I look at him running the floor, and I'm like, fam, run that bum over. If in transition, Grayson Allen's punk ass wants to get in your way, take the foul and run him over. They can't stop you. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. I actually have a Cubs thought. There's a text who's like, kind of meekly said, I know you've been talking White Sox and Bulls, but could you make mention of the Cubs? Actually, it was on my list of things to do today, and I will do it next here on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com in Odyssey Station.
There's supposed to be a Cubs-Rays game tonight. We shall see if they are going to play, but if they do play, they will play here on The Score, and you'll be able to hear the game starting at 640. Making proclamations off of a week of baseball is extremely dangerous. That being said, Cubs may have a dude. Seiya Suzuki is good, man. And here's some of the statistical stuff. He's played a week of baseball, and he's a one war already. That's incredible. Number two, when you start, he's second right now, I believe, in slugging in MLB. When you look at what his short week into career stats are, 400, 543, and an OPS of 1503. He also is one of the league leaders in barrels. And barrels is that perfect nexus of launch angle and exit velocity, 98 or above velocity, 26 to 30 launch angles. He's got six of those already, which puts him at the top of Major League Baseball. The thing that I think will keep him at the top of the Major League rankings is his chase rate. He doesn't chase ball so far out of the strike zone. He's one of the league leaders in that too. His chase rate is about 10%, which is incredible. I don't know how much you're paying attention to Cubs games, and last week's schedule was all odd with them playing on mountain time and stuff, but Seiya Suzuki might be a dude, y'all, and if he is, it can make this summer a whole lot of fun. I'm going to talk with Spiegel and Grody next here on The Score.
Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com in Odyssey Station.
There's supposed to be a Cubs-Rays game tonight. We shall see if they are going to play. But if they do play, they will play here on The Score, and you'll be able to hear the game starting at 6:40. Making proclamations off of a week of baseball is extremely dangerous. That being said, Cubs may have a dude. Seiya Suzuki is good, man. And here's some of the statistical stuff. He's played a week of baseball, and he's a 1 WAR already. That's incredible. Number two, when you start, he's second right now, I believe, in slugging in MLB. When you look at what his short week into career stats are, 400, 543, and an OPS of 1503. He also is one of the league leaders in barrels. And barrels is that perfect nexus of launch angle and exit velocity. 98 or above velocity, 26 to 30 launch angles. He's got six of those already, which puts him at the top of Major League Baseball. The thing that I think will keep him at the top of the Major League rankings is his chase rate. He doesn't chase ball so far out of the strike zone. He's one of the league leaders in that too. His chase rate is about 10%, which is incredible. I don't know how much you're paying attention to Cubs games, and last week's schedule was all odd with them playing on mountain time and stuff, but Seiya Suzuki might be a dude, y'all, and if he is, it can make this summer a whole lot of fun. I'm going to talk with Spiegel and Grody next here on The Score.